On the programme, re-examining creative space and the shape of things. Connemara in the artscapes of Dorothy Cross and the ex-poems of Fiona Groke. Hello and welcome to Arts Tonight. On the programme, two contemporary artists whose work seeks to redefine old ground in visual art and poetry. Dorothy Cross, whose sculptures, installations, film and photos reimagine and evoke the landscapes of Connemara post Paul Henry and Jack B. Yeats, and poet Fiona Groke, who frequently looks to visual art and architectural shape to make considered poems exploring the imaginative space from which art comes. First to Dorothy Cross, whose exhibition Connemara is running at the Royal Hibernian Academy in Dublin, having opened late last year at the Turner Contemporary in Margate in England. After Jack Yeats and Paul Henry and their iconic paintings of the West, how does the modern artist represent Connemara? Well, Dorothy Cross does so in a unique and unexpected fashion. I met her at the large upstairs gallery of the RHA, where in deliberately subdued light, we looked at her selection of strange, surreal objects and images. And I asked her what particular and personal sense of Connemara she carries to the work which surrounded us.
I suppose when you're living there, you don't see it yourself, perhaps. And there's, in some sense, you might come in here looking for clouds and mountains, but there's a very kind of underwater feel about this because of the lack of light. We've dimmed the lights down, so the objects are spotlit. And there are two kind of apertures, which are vertical videos, one of which is a sea cave that's at the end of my land in Connemara, which I didn't discover for 9 months after I bought the land. And I saw a waterfall going into a gully, and I thought, where does that go? And then found this beautiful, beautiful sea cave that you can only access maybe for a few hours a day on the calmest days of the year. So it's an inversion of landscape in a funny way, maybe.
And on the opposite side then, or almost opposite, is Margate and this shell grotto there. Yes. And of course, this show was originally on in Margate late last year into January this year. And I think a certain homage to place in that as well.
Yes, yes. And this is a very, I suppose, it's a very Dorothy interplay, because on the other wall we have this vertical projection of a shell grotto that they think was made in the late, I think, early 19th century. They don't know who made it. It's got these 15-metre-long tunnels that lead to a small room, and they're entirely covered in shells that have faded to black and white over age. But what's so beautiful about it is it's man-made. So you have that opposite, this natural kind of tunnel. And the obsession and the creativity, but the anonymity of it is mesmerising.
And what fascinates me as well is the perspective involved in both of those. And looking, for instance, here at your cave, your Connemara cave, and we're looking in, but we're also looking out. And I think that's wonderful because you get such a sense of the landscape and the movement of water and the rhythm of the sea and of the day in that. Did it take you long to make that film? I mean, did you spend a lot of time in the cave?
No, this particular one did not take long because it's a locked-off shot. But what took long was waiting for the tide to be at the right place because obviously this is full of water when the tide is in. So I had to wait for the weather to be right. Then you have to scramble down a cliff and get in there and then set your camera up. So it's difficult to access it, but it's a terribly simple locked-off shot, in fact. And then what you have, the movement is only these small waves, in this particular case, lapping in towards the camera.
I found myself, when I saw the work for the first time the other night, I found myself thinking a good deal about Singh and his connection to the landscape and the sea. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you designed Vaughan Williams' Riders to the Sea, directed by Fiona Shaw in London about, what, 5-6 years ago.
That's right.
And I presume that an instinct from that as well must run through all the work here.
Yes, that was a beautiful invitation because it was so appropriate for the time, because already I had started working with broken currachs that I'd found lying on the shore. And what Fiona, myself and Tom Pye did was actually got Mehel Mara in Cork, who were these currach makers, to make us 6 currachs that were brought to ENO in the Coliseum in London and flown amongst the production of the Vaughan Williams. But it held an awful lot of what my passion is around, which is the sea. But in the case of Singh and Vaughan Williams, it's the death. Whereas I suppose in some sense, my passion is to enter the sea through scuba diving and swimming, which hopefully doesn't end in death. But it is about that mysterious territory. So the having Vaughan Williams happen, oh, I think it was 6 years ago, some of these works were being made at the same time, actually.
This sense again of the sea, you know, sharks, whales, what's washed up, the submarine. There's so much from the sea. And there's a wonderful line of Seamus Heaney's, from Heaney's poem, Lovers on Arran, where the line, sea broke on land to full identity. And it seems to me that what you're doing here as well is sort of breaking open things to that kind of identity, new identity on land, the way the sea can sometimes sweep things in. And it seems like it sweeps them in for you to re-examine and bring into a new light.
Well, hopefully, I would love if that's what it does, because in some sense, when you're working as an artist, it is dealing with the unconscious and possibly making conscious. So you're orchestrating elements to try and reconstruct new significance. So that analogy of the wave is a beautiful one. I was thinking recently, years ago, I did a show in the Douglas Hyde Gallery with Patrick Murphy, who was then the director there. It was my first big, lovely gift of a space in Dublin. And I called it Ebb. And all the works were about the removal of the ocean to discover the residue. So maybe, like 25 years later, this is another kind of ebb of sorts.
Is there an element of lament at all in your work, as well as a huge aspect of celebration? Because I've been thinking about, you know, again, you've talked about how tied to nature art is. And when you think of what's happening to nature now and our, you know, humans destroying so much, and even when you think of the sea in this past winter and what it has been doing to the coast, I wonder about that aspect of lament.
Yes, there is a massive, especially in a piece called Whale, which you encounter when you first come in the door, which is a Cuvier's beaked whale I found on the beach, which naturally died. But there are considerations around whales being driven mad by sonar submarines underwater that are driving these deep water animals to the surface and they're beaching. So the way I've presented this whale is very, in some ways, a very human kind of abusive pose. It's hung from its tail, this great 5 meter long animal, above a tiny tin bucket empty of water on a marble plinth of acceptance. So I am trying to play with, yes, the sadness, because there's a massive sadness. And, you know, nature maybe is telling us a lot at the moment with weather changing and all that, you know.
Can we go over and look at one particularly striking piece? I mean, they're all remarkable in different ways, but this submarine, a miniature submarine, on a painter's easel, and with a very particular heart in its interior.
Which you wouldn't know was there unless you read the title. Mm. It's called Shark Heart Submarine. And this came about from a project. I was invited to make a sculpture in Chichester Cathedral in England in one of these open competitions, which I struggled with massively. And actually some of the other artists who I knew were in the competition also struggled with, because suddenly you were given this opportunity to make something in this absolute vast, beautiful cathedral that referenced the spirit or the energy of some sense of God, whatever that might be. And my proposal for that was a miniature submarine gilded with gold and inside with a human heart. But then I went and these yacht builders in Kinsale made me this beautiful replica of a submarine out of wood. And we gilded it with white gold. And in its tummy, it's got a little hatch that's perfectly smooth that you can't even see. And inside that hatch is the heart of a shark in a small jar of formaldehyde. And it sits, and this is the most important thing for me because I'm not a painter, and very often, because you live in Connemara, everybody says, what do you paint? And I don't paint because I could never attempt to mimic or represent nature. What I do is I take nature and I play around with it and maybe reconstrue, is that a word?
Yes,
anyway, here it's on a painter's easel, and the painter's easel is a late 19th century easel that's got all the residue of the passion of a painter. And this strange missile-like submarine, which is both about obliteration and destruction, but also about discovery, Jacques Cousteau and all that, which is another passion. So you have this mixture between what I hope art can do, which is discover and go into territories of the unknown. And we live on this planet, but so little is known about the depths of the ocean. It's extraordinary. So that it's got this organ that pulsed in the heart of a shark, not dissimilar to our own hearts invested in this, like a little reliquary.
And of course, again, that sort of almost hidden iconography to an extent as well, the tabernacle behind us, those sort of references that make us look at nature perhaps in, I hope, in a more appreciative way, where we see again, and I think that's one of the remarkable things about what you do, is that you help us to re-see what is around us and which so often we take for granted.
I hope. Yes, the tabernacle, you know, I discovered, I was referring to it as a tabernacle. It's a black, strange structure. But when I read up what a tabernacle meant, it is a place, that a non-permanent structure that would be placed in the desert of Sinai in terms of Judaism, where they locate it to relate to the spirit. But also, it's a groove in a yacht where a mast connects. So you had suddenly this beautiful overlap between the maritime and the spiritual. But this sits in the center of the space, and it's really like a little school meets a cinema, and it's like there's an epidioscope, which is an old system of projection, and it faces this projection of the cave where the light is emanating from the sea. So you have this relationship between projection, which is also obviously what we all have to do to try and move forward, which I think I'm very impatient about, you know.
And wonderful as well to see children here wandering around and looking at, for instance, into that tabernacle, and the scale of it somehow seems to suit them very well. The sea and that element for you, you know, you dive, you swim, it seems to be almost an entirely natural element for you. But at times, I imagine, being in the Atlantic Sea, even in summer, must be pretty tough. And that's something that strikes me about all the work. I mean, we're surrounded by a lot of hard physical work as well as things that are reimagined. You must be pretty fit and determined to make this.
Well, I'm probably not as fit as I used to be. But, there's something about when it's like a dog with a bone when you get an idea. So I find a whale, it's covered in meat. It's too heavy for me to carry. My lovely neighbour, who's since passed away, had a new digger. I asked him to bring it to my field. We place it there on the cliff, away from the prevailing winds, for 2 years. Birds don't touch it because it stinks so badly. And it takes 2 years, really, before it comes down close to the pure bone. So there is a kind of, you know, but it feels natural. It's funny. When I'm working on things, they feel natural. And very often, I don't know if they're going to be works or not. And I just do them. So it's kind of unquestioned. And then it's lovely when you see them coming together. And we had to leave a lot of work out, and then it's about selection, it's about space. In Margate at Turner Contemporary, it was a case of knowing the ocean was on the other side of the wall. Here we don't. So it's a different semblance. But that kind of orchestration is great fun, that kind of theatricization of it in a way. And they become characters, the sculptures, I think, that relate to each other. And then the viewer comes in and hopefully creates more dynamic.
How do you know what material you'll use, for instance? When you see something that you imagine you might reimagine or reinterpret or make new, how do you know, well, I'll make this in bronze or wood, or I'll combine whalebone and bronze? How do you figure that out?
Usually the material, like the whale is the whale, the shark skin is the shark skin, so that's the truest type of material. Bronze is about respectability, I always feel. So I have a piece over there called Ever Shark, and it's a shark that came from a fishmonger's cast in bronze, and instead of its dorsal fin, the range of the Himalayas are growing. So that's about respect for the shark. I have great respect for those animals. The shark evolved to its present state 100 million years ago. Everest only rose to its peak 60 million years ago. So it was made for a show about time, and I think that just, you know, sums it up in terms of respect and survival, you know? So I rarely fabricate things to look like something other than themselves. So in some ways, bronze becomes that kind of neutral territory of making solid something that would have been discarded, and a lot of the other stuff then, like a little tiny curragh covered in a shark skin, that shark would have rotted and rolled back into the sea. Here it's this kind of, it refers to, you know, a cow skin of a coracle or canvas and tar, but it obviously doesn't function. But you have some kind of overlap between the possibility of life connecting to the human life. So it's playing around with that.
And there's a lovely sense of playfulness quite often in the work, and I must say I laughed more than once. And that's always a great pleasure in looking at art. I want to look at, I suppose, what might be the closest thing to some of the more traditional landscapes of Connemara, like maybe to a Paul Henry or Jack Yeats, here beside that wonderful Curragh with the shark skin. It's amazing actually, even passing that, it seems to take on a life of its own. It's this inanimate object, and yet it feels somehow curiously alive, doesn't it?
It does actually. I suppose just because the fin is central, and we had to leave the head of the shark on the beach because it was too heavy and the tide was coming in. It was a young basking shark. They rarely beach. So it does, because the dynamics are like it's the back of a fish going through the water. The reason, and in Turner Contemporary, in Margaret, I also placed it in relationship to this photograph. People think this is a painting. It's, you know, we had to leave a lot out of this show, actually, strangely, because it's one of the biggest spaces in Dublin. But I wanted one landscape in here. And this is Inishturk Island, which I can see out my bedroom window. About, was it 4 or 5 years ago when we had the snow? The islands rarely get covered in snow, but it was beautiful. It was like this iceberg floating on the horizon, and we print them on watercolor paper, and you get this beautiful softness. So it is the closest thing, I think, as you say, to, you know, Paul Henry, who I adore, Paul Henry, but, you know, you can never do another Paul Henry.
Yes, you don't
Henry,
want to be,
you know,
Paul Henry.
I couldn't, you know, nobody can. So I wanted to bring in that sense, also with the title of the show being Connemara, that it brings you back, it grounds you, I suppose, in a way, doesn't
That's
it?
It's a wonderful sense of light in that as well, above snow light.
Yeah.
Are you surrounded by light where you are?
Yes, yeah, and, you know, you're so conscious of weather out there. I find it very hard now to come back to cities, because it changes like that the whole
time. The light from the sea, of course, and the dark from the sea, too.
And the colour of the sea. Incredible, going from turquoise to Prussian blue to black to grey, you know, beautiful.
And then obviously being in the sea, colours must shift
I don't go every day. I don't like the cold.
Maybe
between April and October, that's about it.
You were mentioning bronze being respectable, but I love the kind of unrespectable nature of these, the three bronze, the little crabs.
They're
beautiful.
I love those crabs.
One with a penis on his back.
That's daddy crab.
Yes.
It's called Family, and it's mummy crab, daddy crab, and baby crab. It's very obvious. And I found those three desiccated crabs in a lobster pot in Killary Harbour when I used to have a curragh, which, by the way, was washed away in a storm. And it was in smithereens. But these three crabs were so dried, I took them, and the scale was perfect, big, medium, and little. And a friend of mine made molds, and we cast them in bronze really beautifully. But crabs are exoskeletal, which is, and all their softness is on the inside, so their protective shell is on the outside. And in my early days of work, I did a lot of work with looking at the vulnerability of the penis and cow's udders and all that period of time. So here, the daddy, in inverted commas, has a big penis on his back. So he's kind of ludicrous and encumbered by this appendage that functions almost like a little tank, and he's kind of minding his brood. But I remember Bruce Chatwin reading about his beautiful in Patagonia. He went down to Tierra del Fuego, and he said the word for depression in the Indian dialect translated into the crab without its shell. Terribly beautiful.
Wonderful idea. You know? It's beautiful. Yeah. And what's amazing in that as well is the sense of movement. You know, there is a sense of the scurry of crabs in that. And the Shul Jirukovic, you know, so the old crab to the young crab, you know, walk straight.
The sons
of the old crab to the young crab, which is wonderful, I think.
Fantastic.
And there is a certain sense of that. But I also really love the idea of the kind of strange mutations of nature that we encounter, and there is sometimes inexplicable, so that in fact somehow the daddy crab with the penis on his back seems to make a strange kind of sense.
Yes, I guess so, because presumably they have penises.
But not on the back.
Not on the back.
One of the pieces that I love as well is on the far end of the wall from where we are here, the flippers, the Wellington, the various sort of, again, the sense of movement and what carries us to the sea and from the sea. And it's also somehow very funny. I love the toes sticking out.
Yeah, I call it skins. So it's like the flippers and the boots I found in a cove near my house. And for some reason, over a period of a month, I kept finding black ones. You know, they're nearly old-fashioned now because everything's yellow and pink and blue. and I gathered them, and then I cast, a sound engineer was in my studio, and I noticed he had webbed toes in his sandals. So I cast, asked him, could I cast his feet? And then I make skins of those and patinate them in black. So it's just another layer of existence. The protective layer, then the skin, and they're hung on the wall inside the door as if you've hung up your hat or your coat or your shoe.
What kind of response did you get to the work in Margate?
It's always hard to know what kind of response you get because you put it up and in that particular case I was gone. I went back and did a talk. I think they seemed to like it. You know, it was on in conjunction with a show of Turner and Constable. Mm. And that was really a privilege, but also great fun because I was allowed to place my Charcot submarine on the 19th century easel surrounded by Turner's Constables wonderful. And their buddies. And it, at the opening, I cheekily said, you know, I love that, you know, my work is kind of flanked by these boys. But they were studies from nature that they would have done out in the field that weren't considered to be the most valuable or finished work. So they might turn in their grave if they had seen what was being hung in gold frames. But they were a perfect relationship to what I was trying to talk about in the absence of painting in my own work. Because it's not to say that they're not completely passionately equal, you know what I mean?
Well, of course, Turner as well is so much about how we see. And even like those late Turners that are going to be shown later now in the year, I think in September, and for a long time they were dismissed as evidence of him going blind and not his best work. And now they're being reconsidered as actually quite magnificent and masterpieces and glimpsing them. They certainly look like that. And it's so wonderful to have the work beside Turner.
It was wonderful. Yeah.
And Constable. The Sapiens up here.
Sapiens.
It's Sapiens. Yes. This, the skulls, adult and embryo skull.
Yes. This piece, I'm very fond of this piece, actually, even though, you know, people shy away from skulls. It's an adult skull with a fetal skull growing out of the back of its head, and it sits on a brass tripod. So it functions almost like an instrument, a telescopic camera, you're not too sure. But it's very much about vision. So the adult is facing one direction, the baby skull is facing in the other direction. So is it about one's own lifespan, pointing in different directions from youth to seniority or old age? But I see it as... I've worked a lot with skulls, and I did a photograph years ago where I set a fetal skeleton into the brain space of an adult skull because the position of the fetus in the womb is quite similar to the position of the brain in the head. And so in this particular case, it's a similar thing. It's about a union between, and maybe this is about play as well. It's about the youth and the growth being inextricable, and yet they are... pointing in two different directions, if you know what I mean. But it also probably the whole thing of it being almost like functioning as some kind of visionary tool. I am very impatient in life, actually, about progress. And we are looking at something that we abhor, which is our own skeleton. And yet, possibly, it connects with the tabernacle. But it's something that's interesting in terms of difficulty, actually. It's not easy, that one.
Well, I think of, you know, lots of things looking at this, because I grew up very close to a graveyard and my father was a caretaker and so we were constantly dealing with skulls. And it became as familiar as a sod of turf, you know. It's like, yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I've never had a fear of them, but I'm intrigued by that conjunction, and somehow it makes me think about... also, how life is joined to death, and how we might imagine one from the other. The other piece that I really am taken by is the flowering.
Poetic piece.
Yes, yes,
the poetic. There's a flower in the show. It's a whalebone that came from from a minke whale that I cast in bronze. It's very simple, this piece. And then it's a bog iris that I picked in my field, those beautiful yellow irises, where I actually burn the real flower out. I dip it in wax, so it's a cast of itself. It's not man-made. And then it looks like it's growing out of the whale. So it's about this is about a continuum, I guess, isn't it? A life cycle.
This show, of course, you know, work from the last few years. What are you doing? What are you looking to now?
I'm doing a very exciting show with the Irish Museum of Modern Art, where they're allowing me go into the collections of the National Museum, the Museum of Country Life, the Natural History Museum, the Irish Museum of Modern Art, the Crawford, and select works. And I'm calling it Trove, as in Trouvé, as in treasure, Trove. And it's going to happen actually in November in Emma. So that's a lovely little adventure, actually.
And distraction from the sea.
That's right.
Dorothy Cross, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
RTE Radio 1. You're listening to Arts Tonight, and we move from visual art to poetry and the work of Vona Grork, whose latest collection, simply and sparely entitled X, has just been published by the Gallery Press. Grork is widely considered to be one of the outstanding poets of her generation, and the new book is a Poetry Book Society recommendation in the UK. Grork teaches on the creative writing programme at Manchester University. I've been talking to her about the new book, her sixth collection of poems. She begins by reading the title poem, X.
X. Straight lines only. No curve or arc to double back. No circle in sight from which silence might slip like the strap of a dress off a shoulder one summer field. A shape signifying nothing but a puzzle of itself, made in the box of mourning, untangled over years, from each and every corner of which is visible white space, as if here and now were equal lines, fused the way lovers are fused for as long as it takes to pass through the eye of love, to recover, to egress. Brush-stroked husband and brush-stroked wife, finding in skewered union a defence of loneliness, sectioning in four equal parts, as if it were a family, that safe place, once being full of itself, now cornered, quartered, hinged on a mark that closes on common darkness, the heart of which is silence, certainly, a need expressed in what distends beyond what will not be acknowledged, what will not be allowed, the length and breadth of days that bleed into other days, on which occurs an ardent solitude, windows opening and closing the one sky. I may begin to fold myself along four even lines into the centre of those days, to learn how a life may come to rest on the absence of a life, as crosshairs train on a blank page, as arrows turn in on themselves, as the blades of a bedroom ceiling fan come to a perfectly obvious stop.
Vona Grork, tell me about that poem that gives your new collection its title. X, of course, one of the marvellously adaptable and sinuous letters of the alphabet, and a rather beautiful and primal shape somehow.
Well, that's it. It is a thing in itself, but we also project an awful lot onto the shape that it has. So we project things like X as a substitute for a signature, or to indicate a mistake. And of course, we also use it in common language like X Factor and Triple X and beer and so on. So it's very present in the language, I think, both as a shape but also as a signifier. And I was very interested in the way one letter can accrue so many different meanings and can stand in for so much. And of course, I also thought of it as the sound that the letter X makes. And I thought it would be very interesting to write a poem that might explore some of these areas and that might think about the shape, the physical shape of the letter, but also, I suppose, the resonance that it has in the language.
And, of course, Michael Caine's woodcut lettering of X on the cover of the book, it takes on this other dimension, almost of an anvil, which is very interesting as well in terms of what a letter can make and what can resonate from it.
Well, exactly. It's really physical in its shape, but of course, in the woodcut design of it, there's little gaps in it which make it seem almost slightly fragile or delicate. So it's very declaratory, but it's also kind of delicate, which I think is a fascinating combination.
And the notion of the shape of things and how we see what's around us are subjects that seem to inform some of the poems in this book. You know, there's a strong sense of architecture and building of visual art and painting. And you quote Le Corbusier, "The wall is my everyday friend." And there seems to be almost a parallel between observed material construction and the meticulous construction of the poems. You know, the right word, the right line and stanza, almost as your wall and everyday friend. Is that a fair reading of things?
I think it is. You know, I'm without trying to make a claim to a great philosophical utterance, which I wouldn't be qualified to give, but I do think that we live kind of on two different axes, on a vertical axis, which is, you know, getting places, doing things, being busy, ticking boxes, and noticing the surface of things. And then we also, that's the horizontal axis, and then we also live on a vertical axis, which allows us to probe down deeper into what the surface of things might actually mean. So we are thinking about it, and I suppose in a way it's also a kind of a dialogue between form and content, where content is that kind of horizontal axis and the meaning of things, what's included, the stories that get told and so on, and then also what all of that might add up to, or how we might interpret it, or how it might add to our idea of what it means to be alive, is the other sort of pressure line that gets exerted on the material. And of course that's there in poetry, in terms of form and content. There's the content of the poem, what the poem is about, but that's never enough in itself. You know, the poem will always want to think about what it is as much as it wants to think about what it is about.
And of course, in a way, invisible space and how imagination shapes that space, for instance, to make poetry, also seems to be something of the subject matter that you're addressing. And we see that, for instance, in the two ghost poems in the book. I mean, in the past you've talked about how the ghost in your poetry almost represents that strange nature of art, and how it kind of seeps into our consciousness and our lives. And I wonder, for you, in terms of that's almost spirit of creativity and that impulse of towards and of creativity, is there at times almost a ghostly presence in and around that?
Well, I think there's a ghostly presence, if we're being honest. I think there's a ghostly presence all the time in all our lives, in that, of course, we know that everything we do now takes its point of origin and takes its bearings from what has come before. And that's really all I mean by a ghost, is the way that the past leaves traces or tracks in the life that we lead now. And of course, the poem that I write now is going to be aware not only of the other poems that I have written, but also of the other poems that I've read. The poems that I bring with me to the blank page. And I think this idea of blankness and silence and whiteness is kind of crucial to what happens in the poem. It's almost like photography, with this idea of the negative and the positive. I think the poem is a kind of positive that comes out of the negative of silence and white space. And I suppose the ghostly presences that I'm talking about, these remnants of the past, they exist in the silence and the white space, and out of them then we try to articulate some understanding of what that inheritance might mean.
Talking to Dorothy Cross earlier, I remembered her saying that she inherited these twin aesthetics from her parents, from her mother a love of a perfect Japanese vase, and from her father an appreciation of the anchor, you know, of the more practical side, but still with a beauty. And that in a way seems almost a perfect balance. Was there for you any, you know, family or parental inheritance that informed your way of seeing and, in your case, making poetry?
Oh, I'd love to be able to say some particular things in that way, but I think that might be an artist's sensibility, a visual artist's sensibility. Well, I don't know precisely, but what I do know is that bits of everything that I understand to be me, to be Vona Gruach, to be the poems that I write and the life that I live, I know that there are direct lines that I can perceive between that and between the childhood I had, the person that I became because of my parents as well and my family, as well as the person I became because of my own separate experiences. They are entirely indistinguishable.
The strong impulse in the book towards painting, the poems inspired by, for instance, the Danish artist Wilhelm Hammershøi, Monet's palette. You've written also about painting in the past. For you, what's the imaginative link between one art form and another, say, painting that inspires your poetry? You know, How do these forms link in a way that makes new work possible? Or is that almost impossible to answer?
Well, it is a huge question, but and it's a question that I have been thinking about for years because, as you say, I have been writing about art for years. And I think it has something to do, and I don't say this with any huge authority, but I think it has something to do with stillness. And I think it has something to do with the way that art exists in time. So what do I mean by that? I mean that in a way, most art, like for example a book, will dictate the amount of time that it asks to be dedicated to it. So you can see it's a big book, it needs roughly, you might think, depending on what rate you read, you might think, oh, that's going to be like 2 days, it's going to be a week, it'll take me a month to read it. Or you might look at a book of poems and say I'll read a poem and say I'll read that in so many minutes or so many hours. But with art, it doesn't have that relationship with time. There's no way of looking at a piece of art and getting a sense of the time it claims from you. And I think that that different relationship with the time in which art exists is kind of fascinating for me. And I think that might be something that catches my attention. But then the other thing is this idea of stillness. And that's, I think, what particularly attracted me to Hammershøi, is because he is the consummate painter of stillness and silence. In that when you look at one of his interiors, you see furniture that seems almost like Buddhist in its intensity of its own moment. The chair back is always a chair back. It's very physically aware of itself. And the light is almost tangible in it. So everything has this really steeped, but also really, really quiet and still physical presence. And I thought it would be very interesting to see whether language could actually be made to evoke that same kind of stillness and silence. In a way, it's back to that idea of positive and negative language being silent.
Coming back to the new collection, one of the very striking sequences of poems is 13 garden poems. And they in turn inspired music by the composer Irene Buckley, some of which we'll hear in a while. What inspired those particular poems?
Well, I have this little garden, and it's probably the first garden I've ever really consciously cultivated. But you know, it's only a little garden, and it's if it were a better garden, I probably never would have felt the need to translate it into language in the way that I've done. But in the process of cultivating this garden, I learnt a lot really about. Well, I suppose, what did I learn? I learned that a garden is a place where a human narrative kind of intersects with the narrative of nature, because humans want to plan a garden and they want to say that's where the seat will go, or this will be a blue patch, or I'll put the tall things at the back. So they want to arrange it. But then the natural impulse is resistant to that. And it says, well, I'll seed where I want and, you know, I'll grow in a way you don't expect, or I'll die. So, you know, there seems to be this kind of crux between nature and human desire. And that brought me back to the X. And again, this idea of a little bit of conflict, a little bit of drama, a little bit of contradiction. And I think that kind of fascinated me. But of course, as well, there's a long tradition of writing about gardens in English language poetry. And it's hard to avoid noticing that the garden in that instance is usually standing in for something that's to do with healing, with regeneration, with the idea of regrowth and possibility again.
Could we hear the first poem in that sequence, The Garden as Music and Silence?
Certainly. The Garden as Music and Silence. Only a roofline tin whistle, practicing the parting glass, construes the gap between lupin and rose as possible held breath, inside of which it falls to me to imagine the blue of cornflowers has knowledge of Gothic windows and tapestried plain song. Also, that Tuesday's red geraniums might have something to say about a vowel, and the poppy seed heads something about presentiment they learn to keep to themselves.
Vona, another poem from that sequence, The White Garden, was set to music by the composer Irene Buckley as part of a very interesting project in New York last year. Tell me about that and about that musical link to the poetry.
Yeah, it was called The Middle Kingdom, and it was performed in February of last year in the Irish Arts Centre in New York, and it was about the theme of women's middle age. And it was a collaboration between me, I provided the words, and Irene Buckley, as you've said, provided the music, and her sister Annette sang the songs, and the visual artist Helen O'Leary and her daughter Eva O'Leary, who provided a sequence of images for it as well. And we were all thinking about this theme of women's middle age and just seeing how we could get at it in ways that were not the obvious ways. And it was an extraordinary experience for me, because I'm not used to collaborative work in that way. So to work with a really brilliant composer and really brilliant visual artist was a great learning experience, and was also really enjoyable for me for it not to be just about me and the poems, but to have it open out and include other people. It was a very fun kind of project.
Would you read The White Garden for us, and then we'll hear the setting by Irene Buckley.
The White Garden. The foolish moon, unhinged by darkness, has a word for the white poppy and the tabletop of Carrara marble set with tea from China and cups from a town surrounded by hills. Come the rain, the candy stripe of the summer chair will muster a circus on my watch, and drips from the gutter march a marching band from one fence to the other. Come the wind, the garden will hold up two clenched fists and shout 100 answers to questions I have not asked, and afterwards will have me to know the promise of one kind of love, never leaning against any other. Come morning, the bud vase with the yellow flower will do as best it can. But what colour is the colour of where the last moon used to be?
The White Garden by Fiona Gourke, arranged there and performed by Irene and Annette Buckley. Fiona, you're incoming editor of Poetry Ireland Review. When is your first issue as editor due out, and what are your particular plans for that?
Well, my first issue is the summer issue, so it'll be out in late July or early August. And my plan is to have it as an issue that is dedicated to Seamus Heaney's poems. So what I'm doing is inviting poets from Ireland, from Britain and from America, because Seamus had this poetic life that combined a presence, I think, in all three places. So I'm asking poets from these three places, younger poets, poets of my own generation or younger than me, to write a short essay responding to a poem or a section of a poem by Seamus. So it's all about the poetry, and it's been great fun, actually, because the poets I've asked have been coming back saying that they can think of no finer way of spending time than actually really engaging intensely with a very close reading of lines by Seamus, because he's such a good poet that to immerse yourself in his poetry in that way is always a learning experience as well as a pleasure.
Is there enough critical space given to poetry in Ireland? And I don't mean the publication of poems as such, but more to reviewing, to criticism, you know, discussion and debate about poetry.
Well, there could always be more, that's for sure. But in fact, I think Ireland's not bad. I mean, the fact that the Irish Times makes space for reviewing books of poetry is still a wonderful thing. And all of that space, I mean, we know this, that all of this space for reviewing and talking about poetry has been squeezed by commercial interests and so on. But, you know, people do come to readings, and people do ask questions at readings and generate discussions. And people do, I hope, still buy books and still read them and appreciate not just the words, but also, you know, the value of the book as an artifact, which I think poetry books are very good at being, beautiful in themselves. So I think, you know, it's not bad. It could always be better. But I think we should appreciate the fact that poetry is still part of the, I suppose, the intellectual and the cultural discourse that goes on.
We mentioned the concept of the beautiful vase earlier in relation to Dorothy Cross's work. And one poem in your book, The Yellow Vase, was originally commissioned for an anthology of poems inspired by ideas from the National Museum of Ireland's collections. Tell me about the object you chose to write about and why, and then maybe you'd read that poem for us.
Well, it seems to me that the vase is always a really interesting object in itself because, you know, a well-made vase will have a beauty of form to it. You know, it will consider its line, its materials, its shape, the relationship of the base to the lip, and so on. So it's a beautiful object in itself, but of course it's also a functional object in that it's designed to hold something else, whether that's flowers or whatever. So the vase, of course, reminds me a little of the poem in that it is an object that is well made in itself, but that holds something else to do with content, to do with narrative, perhaps to do with avowal or utterance or declaration or a statement of faith or something of the kind. So this vase that I found in the collection struck me as being something that speaks to itself, to its own presence, its own physical self, but it also throws up immediately ideas of its own usage, of how it has been used and how it might have looked and who might have put objects into it and so on. And I suppose its complexity in that way struck me as being kind of fascinating.
And maybe you'd read that poem for us.
The Yellow Vase. What say you to a windowsill in the ceramics hall, to angling it between the minutes to either side of the sun being certainly up, to letting it tell no story but its own, to give no label, so porcelain snatches of sunlight and cloud be its only inkling of real worlds, tapered onto its very mouth, as though having only a single chance to take from ballast what needs matter most, its emptiness, the certainty of this. In the signal abeyance a body gifts to the historical world, what is hoarded, I ask you, and what offered, what released? Grant this vase between us both the shape of all desire. Have it stand so light discloses every nerve and membrane in its being. Say the glaze must hold still, the gold forget what it cannot contain of blood or disappointment. Say its open mouth must be an antonym to every flower kept from it all this while. Say the space that you vacate I enter, wordlessly, as if longing could be an end in itself, the yellow fact of it being, finally, something to hold in sunlight, something to hold against time.
The Yellow Vase by Vona Grook from her new collection, X. Vona, returning briefly to, I suppose, again, this link between poetry and other art forms. You write about architecture and building in this collection. There's a poem called Architecture, another How to Read a Building. And I wonder, do you have a particular eye for what is made in the world, the material world, what's made materially in the world, and how that links and how that can shape the written word in poetic form?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, that when I look at a building or when I look at a piece of art, I'm seeing it, but I'm also seeing it in terms of what it suggests to me about how language might occupy something of the same space, so that when I see a building and I think of what was intended for it and how the materials were chosen and how do you fit the materials to the idea, and I'm thinking that, you know, that's a kind of a poetic gesture in a way, this negotiation between the real world and the projected ideal world. And of course, that is made manifest in all art and in architecture as well. And I think it's a kind of a fascinating area to think about and to occupy, that crux, again, to use that word, that X between the ideal and the real, the physical and the, I suppose, maybe spiritual is a big word, but I suppose the world of spiritual ambition.
We deal in apertures, you say, in how to read a building, and in a way that seems to speak almost as much for poetry as for what we construct from brick and mortar.
Well, that's it. We never or rarely see the whole picture. We see a tiny chink of it. We notice the detail, and in really paying attention to the specific detail, we begin to understand or to accrue a sense of what the detail signifies. And for me as a poet or as an artist, I think that's how it works best, is to look up hard and in close and with intense attention to the small elements, and then to try and piece my understanding of the details together into something larger. So not to see necessarily the whole building, but to see perhaps a corner or the way the light falls on the handrail of the staircase or some small detail that it will essentially, if it's a well-made building for me, it will embody, I think, the ambition of the building as a whole.
Can we finish with your poem, How to Read a Building?
Yes. How to read a building. Don't. You might as well say a morning convenes in panelled reflections of itself, or call the way a roofline predicts its likely outcome, fate. Right, arch. So the word has to position itself between noun and adjective. Put lintel as a title. See what comes of it. I, too, may think of line endings with every quoin or cant, of surface meaning caulked airtight, of metaphor constructed as a tinted curtain wall. I am alive, yes, to the notion of cantilevered sound, open to rhymes between stone and stained glass, sunlight and cement. Say what you like. There's a name for every kind of window you could possibly see through. But the room with no window has no first line, and all its stowaway fictions need to be written in dark ink. So we deal in apertures, we say, in the business of proportional reveal. Twice that I know of, it falls into place. Once when sand in mortar is listening to rain, and again when slate roof tiles recall small words in a ghost hand that rubbed them clean away.
Fiona Grock, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
And X by Fiona Grock is published by the Gallery Press and will be launched at the Little Museum of Dublin tomorrow evening at 6:30. Connemara runs at the Royal Hibernian Academy in Dublin until the 27th of April. And a rather beautiful book based on Dorothy Cross's work and also called Connemara is published by the RHA. That's it from us. Back next Monday at 10, we'll be discussing the critical space given to reviews and discussion of literature and the visual arts in Ireland. Join me then. Good night.